Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 8:35 on the morning of Wednesday, April the 7th, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, Senator Wilikowski and myself, Senator French. We have four bills on the calendar, although I understand that SB 249, the CS, is not ready, the public records bill. So that'll be taken off the calendar. Let's start with a bill I think that's ready to move, and that is SB 303, Workers' Compensation and Contractors. We have the prime sponsor and his chief of staff, Senator Pascvan and Mr. Stepp. We've also been joined by Senator McGuire. Welcome, Senator McGuire.
Good morning.
We are bringing up SB 303, Senator Pascvan's bill on subcontractor, contractors, and project owners' liability for workers' compensation. We heard the bill. Had community discussion. We do need to adopt a CS. The backslash before us is backslash S. If we could get a motion.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
It's been moved that we adopt the backslash S. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. Senator Pascvan, do you want to make any sort of wrap-up remarks on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick review of the two major goals that Senate Bill 303 is designed to accomplish. One is it restores the workers' compensation statutory structure to the same good policy that our founding fathers established at statehood. And that basic policy was that if you break it, you pay for it. And it worked well for Alaskans who were injured or killed on construction sites until it was changed in 2004. That change in 2004 gave immunity to project owners, general contractors, or others who, even with criminal negligence, injured or killed an employee of the subcontractor. And, Mr. Chairman, I would submit that that's bad public policy, that if someone can act with criminal negligence and kill someone, that they are not accountable or not responsible. So that was the basic premise of the bill. The committee substitute adds essentially 10 lines, and that is found in Section 3 of the committee substitute. In other words, 1, 2, and 4 were the changes that return Alaska to the previous law. Section 3 adds a new section which says a subcontractor who is hired by a contractor as an independent contractor who has no employees during the term of the contract is liable for and shall secure the payment of compensation under the workers' compensation statute that provides coverage for this contractor and shall produce a certificate of workers' compensation insurance coverage for the project. Subsection H in that Section 3 then says that if the subcontractor fails to do that and there results in a premium that is billed to the contractor, that the subcontractor is liable for the amount of that additional premium and any penalties associated with it. And so it completes good social policy as far as the financial responsibility on a project within the workers' compensation context. So those are the two major goals, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for those wrap-up remarks. With that, we've heard public testimony. We have someone signed up to testify, but I'm afraid we closed public testimony at the last hearing. And with that, is there a motion? Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 303 / S out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object just to make an observation, and then I'm not going to keep that objection. But I'm beginning to understand why this bill needs to be done. But it looks to me like the requirement now for an individual subcontractor to buy that workers' comp is something that I'm going to have to study out. I don't understand that exactly, but as best I should. It looks to me like it's an economic levelizer rather than a compensation problem. So I'll talk to the sponsor on that. But the fairness standard is what was appealed to me on, and I agree there should be an equity and the idea that if you break it, you should fix it. So what we did is we've took the, and I'm going to say this so that the sponsor can instruct me as we go along through this process. The way I understand it is, right now the owner of a project is subject to the workers' compensation laws, and that's not sufficient for some circumstances. So we're going to take them out so that they can be liable to be sued, but we're going to leave the main contractor under the workers' comp and not give them the responsibility of having to bear for the same problem that might occur with the owner. So the fairness standard only goes part way in my view. I just wonder about it. I don't understand why we're not going the whole way, but I don't know enough about the system to put an amendment in to say we should do that, because then the whole reason for workers' comp kind of starts dissipating, I think. So I think I understand that. So I'm going to put a no recommendation on this, because I really don't know enough to understand what the ramification beyond the actual verbiage is. And I listened very carefully to the Tesoro testimony. They become liable at a huge level, where some of your contractors who work with them don't bear that same liability. So I don't know if we're actually reaching a fairness that the sponsor put forward, but I'm open to discussion. We'll continue the dialogue with them, and so therefore I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Is there further objection? Without objection, then the bill's left committee. Thank you, Senator Pascrean, and thanks for those remarks, Senator Coghill. I'll leave it to you two to have a further discussion about some of the nuances and the fairness and so forth. But with that, the bill is moved, and we will turn now to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Very good. To House Bill 386. We're still waiting for the last amendments to come into SB 222. We'll wait till they're all assembled to move to that. So we may get about halfway through your presentation, Representative Hawker, and welcome to the committee. And then, as you know, during this time of year, things are moving quickly. And so we'll ask for your indulgence if we have to interrupt your presentation.
Not a problem, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I am Representative Mike Hawker, District 32, South Central Alaska. In recognizing the time issues, this bill is actually a very simple bill. It's got a lot of paper, but a number of pages. But what it does is the bill was introduced at the request of the Department of Public Safety. We're working with them as a courtesy. And at their behest, this bill simply empowers the Department of Public Safety to prescribe a uniform and standardized format for citations, as well as standardizing the process for people who have received a citation to deal with it. Our laws, of course, have evolved over many, many years in the state, and every time we put in a section of statute that involved a citation, typically it was not conformed to all the other sections, and so there's a myriad of paper formats out there and a myriad of processes that the Department of Public Safety believes if they were empowered to standardize, they could increase both efficiency, effectiveness of their operations, including both operating efficiency and cost reductions. It is particularly important as we pursue an increasing utilization of electronic technology, electronic processing, literally paying your fines over the internet type things. They, of course, need a standardized format, and computers just don't work well if we don't standardize the processes and formats. So, sir, the bill before you is it addresses a lot of different sections of statute, but it's simply going through and providing for a standard citation format and making all the conforming changes in the various sections of the statute regarding citations.
Very good. We're getting a series of pops and kicks this morning. I'm just not sure. Do we know where they're coming from? It's just the poltergeists. Very good. Thank you for that brief overview. Representative Hawker, Ms. Lucky, do you want to walk us through some of the more substantive parts of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I am staff to Representative Mike Hawker. In your packets, you should have a prepared overview, and I think that's probably the easiest way to go through the bill. It allows me to go through just 10 of the 65 sections and then answer any questions that you might have.
Very good.
So if you, do all of you have the?
I have this.
That is it.
Very good.
And this basically goes over the meat of the bill, and I can correspond to the sections if we need to. Section 21, that would set out the requirements for the standard citation format. And it requires the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety to prescribe the standard format and adopt regulations to do so. And it sets out certain things that need to happen with the citations. A lot of the other ones are just, that is the new section of law. And a lot of the sections that come after that are going to be more conforming sections. In Section 22, most of the changes are technical changes to put it in active voice. There is one, I guess what you would call a substantive change It's not really a substantive change, but this is something that's been a stickler for some people, and that's on page 6, line 7.
But you're on the second bullet point.
On this.
Yes, we have moved
to the second bullet
point. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. That's fine.
So this would be section 22 of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, most of the changes were to kind of get it into active voice. And the change that some people have kind of commented on is on line 7, where we're changing has reasonable and probable cause to believe to reasonably believes. And it is my understanding from both talking to Department of Law and from our legislative drafters that in this instance, the language change doesn't actually have an effective change. The problem was this is the only place where reasonable and probable cause to believe appears in statute. So the thought was that if we went with the reasonably believes language, that mirrors other places in statute where somebody has to make a judgment call, but it's not a probable cause where you have an actual violation. And so here we have the contacting officer reasonably believes the person is a danger to self or others, and that was the bar that they thought was appropriate.
Let me just stop you, and I'll go ahead and opine that I think that's a good change. I think joining reasonable cause and probable cause in the same sentence is confusing. Mm-hmm. They're two different standards, and it just didn't make sense to have them both there at the same time. And reasonable belief is probably the appropriate field sort of screening standard for an officer. And I'm sure that's what you've learned in other committees.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, or as the committee, that's what we've learned. And by looking through the statute and realizing this was the only place it appeared in statute, it seemed like a reasonable change.
Great. Other comments on that point? Don't see any.
And section 23, many of the changes, of course, are technical in nature. We are removing a section that says that a person can request an earlier hearing. And it's my understanding that because you're giving a ticket in the field, there's a five-day deadline. And there's really the way that it works, tickets can't really get anywhere faster than 5 days. And so since that, I think that, and the department can correct me if I'm wrong, if there's a problem, if someone has a question about this section, but it's my understanding that if you did need to have it sooner, there is still a method that you could request that. They're just taking it out of the statute here.
I guess I just have to stop and ask a question, whether this bill has been sort of a magnet for everyone who ever wanted to tell their ticket story.
Yeah.
To you.
I <bet. laughs>
Because I've got one, and I'm resisting it, but I've just got to believe that it's happened to me. It's been happening to you all throughout this process.
It certainly brings back a lot of memories for many folks.
Very good. We'll just keep on plowing ahead. Thank you, Ms. Lucky.
And you'll see in that section there's also a lot of deletion of language, and that's because with the approval of standard deadlines, we don't need to have a bunch of different deadlines in statute, and that's a lot of the language that's been taken out there. Section 24 is a little confusing because it has to be in there because of the Boating Safety Act, basically. So we have an act that modified the section of statute that then sunsets. So in order to construct our bill correctly, we have to have section 24 that looks almost exactly like section 23, but has an effective date that if the Boating Safety Act does in fact sunset, this will become law. Section 25 says.
So which bullet point are we on now?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
On. I should have put the section numbers in here. I apologize for that. It's the 12-25-195.
Got it.
Bullet point. And that would be in section 25 of the bill. And it adds the language, does not contest the citation. The person may, that was more of an oversight. Obviously, if someone's contesting the citation, they're not going to be mailing it back and saying they don't contest the citation. And then we're putting in the 30-day deadline, which will be the one deadline, as opposed to having some of them had 15 and 30 deadlines for the payment date for what they call a scheduled offense. And I don't know if you guys need me to go over what the scheduled offenses are. All right. Section 26 is more about where we have the form of citation. The only thing that I'll point out there is that we are putting must be in writing. There was some concern that we're taking out must be in writing in other places. So I just wanted to point out that we do require that the citation be in writing. Most of the other changes there are technical in nature. Section 27, which is 210, the bullet point for 210, it really talks about the record keeping. We have the record keeping requirements for peace officers, so this is bringing in other people who are allowed to give citations to the same record keeping requirements. And also says that their failure to file the citation is not a basis for dismissal of the citation. So if a an issuing agency misses their 10-day deadline, it doesn't actually require the citation to be dismissed. And that was the question that was brought up in the House Judiciary Committee. Section 28, again, is more of the technical changes, and Section 29. So what they're doing is they're saying anybody else, you know, the statute used to read just for peace officers, so this is putting the other agencies into those sections. And then Section 230, which is kind of the last section of the meat, or Sections 30 and 31 of the bill, which is Section 1225-230 of statute, are the penalty sections. And so throughout the statutes, there were various penalties this kind of that were confusing, because some of them said you could have a citation and the court said we're not, or a summons to do the citation, and there was some question about what does the summons mean? Is the summons a misdemeanor? And if it is, what kind of misdemeanor is it? So it was more clear to put in this is a Class A misdemeanor or a Class B misdemeanor. So it basically puts the penalties into two separate sections. Section A would deal with the not scheduled offenses, and Section B would deal with the scheduled offenses. So this is what happens if you do, if you don't pay your bail, or if you don't meet, some of the tickets might have something like you have to get something fixed. And so if you don't do that, if you don't show up to court, you don't do what the ticket requires you to do, or you don't pay, these would be the penalty sections. There was some concern about these penalty sections and whether or not we are putting a higher, you know, a higher misdemeanor on some of these offenses. And I have personally gone through all the ones that are being changed to make sure that we aren't actually making a higher crime for something. I had our legal department check. They did not find anything, and Department of Law assures me that we are not making a misdemeanor where there wasn't one before.
The I see a question. I've got, I think, one or maybe, did you want to finish up on that? And then let's just stick on that point for a minute. Do you have more you want to say on that?
There was a question about the Class A misdemeanor. It is my understanding that reading a statute, if a misdemeanor is unclassified, that it is automatically a Class A misdemeanor. So what they've done in this section is instead of saying any old misdemeanor and then kind of relying on the legal interpretation that any unclassified misdemeanor is a Class A misdemeanor, they put it in this statute to be, for it to be clear that what we're talking about is a Class A misdemeanor. The repealed section was a little confusing about what they actually meant. And the way that it could be interpreted by some was that the punishment for a scheduled offense would be the exact same as one for a non-scheduled offense. So in order to get rid of that confusion, they repealed the language that was there and put in that it is a Class B misdemeanor. And then that's, as I said, the meat of the bill. There are a few technical changes that, I mean, I guess if you're putting 65 sections into law, if you see something that might need to be fixed along the way, I can go over those sections. But the majority of the bill is just conforming to those changes and deadlines.
Let's just stay for a moment where we just were, and that's sections 30 and 31. And just to get everybody oriented, these are provisions that penalize someone for essentially not dealing with the citation they were issued. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And you've mentioned scheduled and unscheduled offenses. Maybe you can give us a couple of examples of what each of those are. That is, what's a scheduled offense and what's an unscheduled one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. A scheduled offense is an offense where you say, you have this ticket, and this, as I understand it, this ticket is $25. So there is a schedule of fees. You park in the wrong place, it is this amount of money. You do this, it is this amount of money. That's a scheduled offense, and it is my understanding that anything else that does not have a particular fee for that particular item that is adopted by, you know, municipal code or whatever code adopts those for whatever jurisdiction you're in. The unscheduled offenses are those that do not have a schedule of fines.
A bail schedule or a fine schedule.
Right.
And so like speeding, unscheduled?
And that I might ask, just so I don't say it incorrectly,
okay.
I think we do have some representatives from DPS that can give you a little
okay.
more.
Or maybe you can do, what's another example of an unscheduled one that you're sure of?
Yeah, that's,
okay, we'll defer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I know what the scheduled offenses
okay.
are. I don't think I've received enough tickets to.
Okay. Well, let's see who wants to raise their hand.
Lieutenant Peterson is online.
Okay.
And she can speak to those issues.
Okay. Maybe we'll turn to her while we've got her. Do you have a, okay?
I can wait.
Lieutenant Peterson, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, and we have a couple questions for you.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Kat Peterson. I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers.
And thank you, Lieutenant Peterson. Can you tell us a bit about, I think we know now what a scheduled offense is, but can you give us some examples of unscheduled offenses?
Yes, and just to answer your question a minute ago, speeding is a scheduled offense. It has a actual bail amount that can be provided on the citation. The unscheduled offenses are those that require a mandatory court appearance. And there's, and I was trying to find one, minor consuming is one of those that is a mandatory court appearance where you have to go to court to find out what your bail is. We can't tell you what that is on the side of the road. Same with minor operating a vehicle after consuming alcohol. Those type of offenses. Also, tampering with official traffic control devices is some of those same type of offenses.
But you're not up into the, we're not up into, like, possession of marijuana or things like that.
Those are actual criminal.
Right.
What I was talking about were mandatory infractions.
Right.
And there's not a lot of mandatory infractions left on the books that don't have bail already put them on the schedule until you get into the, you know, the criminal offenses like driving while your license is suspended, those which are actually criminal in nature. Some of the commercial vehicle speeding over 20 miles per hour in a school zone is a mandatory infraction, so you have to go to court to, you know, deal with those citations.
So just looking over, to kind of restate what Ms. Lucky told us about Sections 30 and 31, Section 31 says if you don't show up to pay the bail or fine or appear in court in response to a citation for a scheduled offense, then you're on for a B misdemeanor, and those are speeding, headlight out, taillight out, things like that.
Correct.
On the other hand, if you don't show up for a minor consuming, minor operating, tampering with a traffic device, then you're on the hook for a Class A misdemeanor.
Correct.
Okay. Very good. Further questions on this issue?
Just
Senator Coghill.
Not with the troopers, but with the sponsor. Some of those questions were already asked, so I'm going to go to the other end of the question that I was thinking about. I can remember while I was a member in the House, we voted on an issue that actually had an offense but didn't have a fine attached to it because they didn't want to make it criminal. It was, I think, the CO2 issues, and we gave the fire department the ability to issue a citation, but we didn't assign a penalty to it. So my guess is now that becomes a penalty, and that was a deliberate policy call that they made to give the fire department the authority to say, you know, this could be a citation, but there was no penalty attached to it. So it was one of those policy calls that we made. And in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, they're right now, as we speak, debating whether they want to have the CO2, I mean the particulates from your furnace, an offense. And they're debating on whether it should have a misdemeanor attached to it or if there should be just the ability to encourage them to get a reinvestment. So those are, as soon as I looked at your citations and you're broadening the authority, I was just wondering how that authority reached into those areas like the police or some local area where they have an ordinance that they haven't assigned a huge penalty to, but they wanted the ability to say, you know, we have a law that says you should do this and issue a citation and then try to encourage you or to cajole you really into doing something. So, and I was looking through this, I didn't see how that affected it, but it looks like the authority went pretty broad.
Response, sir?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill, they did put in this section of the bill that says, or otherwise specifically provided by law. And when I went through the laws that we were taking out the specific provision in the law, all of them included Class A or Class B misdemeanors. I'm not familiar with that particular section because that wasn't one of the ones that we looked at for our bill, but what I can do is see if that law does specifically say that that's a violation with a fine of zero or or something like that. So I could definitely look that up, and we haven't run into, I'm unsure if specifically provided by law would include an ordinance, and so I can double check with our legal counsel and find out if an exception
is. And I won't hold a bill up, but it's just knowing that various different communities are going to make those policy calls for a variety of different reasons and don't want to assign a misdemeanor to it. Some of it is because of their enforcement capacity. they would have to take it to a state court, basically. But they want to be able to say, based on our taxing scheme, whatever, we want to be able to put pressure on certain behaviors. And so just something to think about.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Cockhill, I understand your concern, and I believe that it would be taken care of because specifically provided by law, we do allow you to say a fine of zero or something like that to be the penalty, but I will definitely check on that and get back to you.
I'd appreciate that, and I'll look through this too. That was the two spectrums, the one that the Senator Chairman was asking and then all the way down to the local level. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly, and let me just turn back to Lieutenant Peterson, if you're there. I want to ask you, because we move the penalties around on this fairly regularly, what's currently the maximum penalty for a minor in possession or consuming alcohol?
That's a little tricky to answer, Mr. Chairman, because the first offense and the second offense are infractions, and the third offense turns into what's called habitual and then becomes a misdemeanor.
Let's just focus on the first or second offense.
On the infraction, it's $300, and generally from what I've seen around the state is about a $100 fine is basically what I think most people are coming away from with a fine, but it's $300 is the cap.
Sure. And is there any mandatory, like community work service or things like that?
I have not seen that as a constant around the state, that there's any type of mandatory community work service going on currently.
We may get a different response from the Department of Law, but I'll ask them here in a minute. And I guess the reason I bring it up is that, you're taking someone, I guess, under 21, right, minor in possession. And if they miss court, they've gone from facing a $300 fine to facing a year in jail. And that's the same penalty we apply to people who are charged with domestic violence or DWI who miss their court hearings. And so I may puzzle on that for a little bit about whether we're not sort of over-ratcheting up the, people need to deal with their citations. But in general, we penalize you for failing to appear about the same level that we've charged you, right? If you're charged with a misdemeanor and you miss court, it's a misdemeanor. If you're charged with a felony and you miss court, it's a felony. And we're charging folks who are missing court on a speeding ticket now with jail time.
And most of the misdemeanors do not get jail time, and I think the Department of Law can explain that. Most of them are a fine, but the other thing I wanted to point out is where it says, or another state, at this language there, most of the time anything that's on a scheduled fine is processed through your permanent fund dividend, and it's not actually changed into an A or a B misdemeanor, which is, I think, the current allowable in the law.
So just let me connect the dots there. It sounds like you're saying if you miss court, you're going to be found guilty, you're going to be assessed a fine, and we're going to grab that out of your permanent fund dividend, and you're probably not going to get charged with the failure to appear?
Yes, that's what's happening today.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions on this point? Don't hear us any. Any more wrap-up remarks about the bill? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Wilikowski.
Another point. I don't know if it was covered or not, but page 6, lines 7 and 8, we're changing the probable. We're taking out probable cause to believe on when.
Lines 7 and 8?
Yes.
Right.
And,
right.
Have you gone over this?
We talked about it briefly, and the issue is sort of the joining of two standards, reasonable cause and probable cause, in the same sentence, which I believe was probably the source of some confusion over the years, and replacing that with reasonable beliefs. And it may be best at this point maybe to turn to someone from the Department of Law and have them kind of walk through why that's significant. So anything else from the sponsor, you, Ms. Lucky? Great. Let's turn to the Department of Law.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Brower, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Senator French. I'm Dave Brower, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. I had a hand in writing some of this bill. through the chair, to answer, I think, Senator Coghill's question and other questions about changing the statute from 1225-230A as an A misdemeanor and B is now a B misdemeanor. I think just a little clarification. There are several misdemeanors that are specific, and 1225-230 was a specific misdemeanor. You could get up to a year in jail under A and B, in my opinion, and a fine of $1,000. Yeah, yeah. So that changed it from, that wasn't an A misdemeanor, because an A misdemeanor has a higher fine, I believe.
What you call like a special class misdemeanor.
Right, a non-classified misdemeanor. Some of the language in the statutes gets confusing. There is a unclassified felonies that are specific felonies, like murder and very serious.
Now I'm...
You're fine. Oh. Keep going.
Failure to appear is a particular crime, and there's a bill circulating now amending that. But failure to appear is a non-classified misdemeanor because it doesn't have a particular fine. It's not an A or a B. So change from in 230 to an A misdemeanor in section A and a B misdemeanor actually, I think, lowers the penalty. Prior to, the current law is if someone does not has a bailable offense or they can pay that or the fine, and they don't appear, the statute now says the citation essentially is converted into a summons. But that's, I think, impossible, because a summons has to indicate what crime you're being summons for, and the citation would not have that, because the failing to appear is a different crime. And you don't automatically get charged with failure to appear if you don't appear. That has to come from the prosecutor. So, okay. And the other question was about...
the general
reasonable cause.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Again, excuse me. Again, in the law, there are terms of art like probable cause, reasonable suspicion, and they get kind of mixed up in the statute sometimes. There was I don't recall the precise language for using a preliminary breath testing instrument for if you had reasonable cause to do it, and the Court of Appeals determined, well, that had to be probable cause because it's a search, and you can't do a search without probable cause. So that statute got changed. In this statute, where there's reasonable cause or probable cause, that is giving the police the discretion to arrest someone. And I think the primary goal is not to arrest someone unless the officer reasonably believes that they're a danger or has probable cause to believe they're a danger. If you have probable cause to believe a crime is committed, you can look at certain elements and see if those elements are present. If you have probable cause to believe someone is a danger, I think it turns on a reasonable belief, because there is no crime of danger, and what would probable cause be? I think it was too confusing, but I don't think that the change will have any practical effect.
Senator Wilikowski.
I thought what I heard you say was that reasonable cause is slightly as a lower standard than probable cause. Is that?
Well, I think reasonable cause isn't really a standard. And
or reasonably believes.
Yeah. Reasonably believes would be.
It's reasonable suspicion. That's the other. That's the lower. That's the other field sort of contact standard, right? For a patent frisk or so forth.
And reasonable suspicion and probable cause are terms that are used for police to and courts to determine whether an officer had a reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime, some type of crime, was happening, like whether there was a danger. Probable cause has to be the elements of the crime are actually met by the certain facts that the officer knows. In this case, the officer already has probable cause to cite the person for whatever violation, and they can arrest the person if the person refuses to take the citation, refuses to identify themselves. But if they don't do that, they can be arrested if they are a danger, and the officer has to make a determination.
Yeah, and it's something I'm all over. It seems, if I'm hearing you correctly, that we're lowering the standard for arresting someone. And when you're making it easier for officers to arrest someone.
Well, not really, because the officer already has the authority to arrest someone in that situation, because they have probable cause.
Well, it says... The officer's discretion, issue a citation. Okay, so I guess they do. In this particular case, it's purely the officer's discretion to either issue the citation or take them to the court.
Right, and the language in the part that had reasonable cause or probable cause was essentially taking that discretion away and requiring the officer to arrest someone.
Okay, interesting.
We'll mull that over. I think let me ask the bill's sponsor what committee path this piece of legislation still has ahead of it after this one, or Ms. Lucky.
Mr. Chairman, Julie Lucky for Representative Hawker. This would be the last committee of referral.
Excellent.
Okay. And I would like to, and I can provide this for the committee if they find this helpful. After we had this discussion in House Judiciary Committee, I did kind of comb through the statute so that I could find out where else we see this language. And as I said, the phrase that we're taking out does not appear anywhere else in statute. However, there is another section of statute, which is 4712245, which I have not put in the packets, but I can provide to the committee, regarding delinquent minors. And it's the same sort of thing where we're talking about when the peace officer should arrest or shouldn't. And you'll see in there that anytime there is if the peace officer reasonably believes the minor is a fugitive from justice, or if the peace officer has probable cause to believe the minor has violated a condition of the minor's release or probation. And I think that this section of statute really illustrates the point that Department of Law is talking about, where you have probable cause that a violation has occurred, where you have elements of a crime, or a reasonable belief where we're asking for you to make an opinion on maybe the state of affairs or the state of mind of the person that you're citing. And I'll be happy to provide that to the committee. It's not mentioned in our bill, which is why I did not put it in the packet, but as I was doing the research when this question had come up earlier, I thought this illustrated the point the Department of Law was making.
Very good. Other questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Brower? It is a lengthy bill. It will take a couple days to mull it over, but it looks like we're in good shape to get this bill to the floor in time for the end of the session. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Let's turn now to SB 222. Yeah, actually, why don't we take a short at ease? We're back on the record. We're back on the record for Senate Bill 222. We are working off the backslash echo, a CS we adopted back on the 5th of April. We have three proposed amendments that come to us after a period of negotiation between my office and the Department of Law. And the first is amendment number one. It'll be by me, Senator French. I will, if someone else could move the, I'll move the amendment and object to it myself and then explain what it does. So amendment number one goes to page 8, line 11. And page 8, line 11, you'll see, deals with the new a new provision in our law that's going to give subpoena power to the Attorney General in cases involving the use of an Internet service account in the exploitation of children. And we understood through previous testimony, maybe Ms. McClain, you can come forward, great. We understood through previous testimony that there might be some issue about these administrative subpoenas being challenged if the subpoenas were going to collect, and we're on line 11, collect material dealing with the address associated with the account and collect information regarding credit cards, which has been deleted by the amendment. Actually, here's what I can do. I'm going to read through the way the section will read after we adopt the amendment, because it's kind of hard to look through this and see how it's going to read. And so I'm just going to start on line 8, and this is how it will read once we adopt the amendment. A person receiving a subpoena under A of this section shall disclose for the account that is the subject of the subpoena, 1, the name of the person holding the account, 2, the address and physical location associated with the account, and what will become now 3, length of service, including start date and types of service used by the account. And the other material in that section is deleted. Ms. McClain, does that comport with your understanding of the amendment?
That comports with my excuse me.
Welcome.
Good morning, Senator French.
Welcome.
This is Sue McLean from the Department of Law, and yes, that comports with my understanding of the amendment.
And does the Department of Law support the amendment?
Yes.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to remove my objection and see whether there's further discussion or committee comment on the amendment. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And so just so that I understand, you're deleting the section dealing with a requirement that disclosure of local long-distance telephone connection records.
Right.
Okay. And can I just hear a little bit of thought on that?
Ms. McLean.
We had this, through the chair, Senator McGuire, we asked our Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals for their opinion on where, within the realm of personal privacy, and particularly given new statutes that passed in this body last year, creating some serious protections for personally identifiable information, where we felt we could go without running afoul of either the statute or the Alaska Constitution. We're not talking about the federal Constitution. We're talking about the Alaska Constitution. And the opinion was that local and long-distance telephone records, including records of sessions and times and durations for the account, would include personal telephone calls that had nothing to do with this, and that that would be an invasion. Or that we would have a difficult time if someone challenged on that ground, that this was so broad it would allow someone to look into your personal telephone call to your mother.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. If I might, I guess I understand that, and I understand our specific right to privacy in the Constitution. And that said, I just want to know. I guess it'd be nice to hear from the investigative unit. I mean, the prosecution team always has their opinion, and that's important as well, about what they think they can support in the courtroom, but for the investigator, I guess when you're looking at proof and issues of trying to sew these things up, is that a missing link? Is it going to be a missing link not to be able to connect the duration of time someone is on the internet associated with a certain connection, and then, of course, the viewing of those images of children?
Let's, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we do have Sergeant DeGraff on the phone, and so he's probably the best person to answer that question. And let's just keep in mind, again, this is the first step. This is the administrative subpoena that lets the officer sort of identify the suspect. And then, of course, they're going to have to go back for a subsequent search warrant to swoop in and grab the computer and so forth. But let's turn to Sergeant DeGraff. If you're on the line and you followed the discussion, welcome. Please put yourself on the record, and you can tell Senator McGuire and the rest of us your views on this.
Yes, sir. Thank you. This is Sergeant Derek DeGraff.
Hang on 1 second. We're bringing your volume up. So just hang on 1 second.
Sure.
Or get in close to the mic. Okay, just make sure you've got that receiver right up to your mouth, please, Sergeant.
Okay. This is Sergeant Derek DeGraff with the Alaska State Troopers.
Welcome.
To answer through the chair, the first comment I heard was that if that record is removed for the phone numbers associated with the account, will that affect our ability to do our job? The primary answer is no. I mean, the key thing that we want is the name and the physical address of the location of what the IP address comes back to. That is our primary concern. secondary to that, would be obtaining a phone number. Just because there are other searches we can do and try and tie other records, and that would help us identify who may or may not be using services at that residence. But it's not detriment to this new rendering of the bill. The second comment, and I might be putting the cart in front of the horse here, but where the bank accounts, that is also secondary to us getting, the primary information again, which is the house and location. We would certainly support the bill in the new format that it's in with those items removed. The primary reason for wanting those other records for us is to help us determine who else may or may not be using that. As I think many folks have heard me testify before, you know, one of the things that we want to do is make sure, you know, we can identify who's there. We have to put a person behind the keyboard, and those other secondary records can help provide some clarification for us. But I certainly do support the bill in the format that's in, and if removing those couple of items helps us bring everybody to the same page, we would certainly go along with that.
Thanks. We appreciate hearing from you, and we have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Not a question, but just a statement on this section. And this section only applies to the subpoena power of the Attorney General. And I think a lot of people, rightly so, would be concerned of giving an Attorney General really vast power to go ahead without any judicial review at all and get information. The Attorney General is free to go ahead to a court and ask a court to issue a warrant for this information, but to give the Attorney General the really unfettered subpoena power to go and get this information, I think is what this is directed at, Mr. Chair, and I support the amendment.
Right, and I think, you know, we've reached a balance where, you know, the Attorney General still has to have a reasonable cause to believe that the internet service account has been used in the exploitation or attempted exploitation of children, but it is a new power under our law. And so I think, you know, this is a good place for us to start, see what kind of challenges we get, you know, withstand those challenges, win them, and then, you know, go from there. So with that, my objection has been removed to Amendment Number 1. Further objection? Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. Amendment number E.2 is again going to be by me, Senator French. I will move it. I will object to it. And this is a provision that we, meaning my office, put into this bill as a result of the one-day crime hearings we had last summer regarding reporting by smaller police departments around the state of the particularly the felony sex offenses committed in their jurisdiction. We heard from Lieutenant Colonel Holloway, who told us we're just not getting the data we want out of some of the smaller areas in the state, leaving us kind of wondering what the level of sex offense activity is there. This provision corrects that, and I think it's fairly non-controversial. My aide's handing me a note saying this is a rewrite by the Department of Public Safety of that earlier provision. And so, Ms. McClain, do you want to make any comment?
Thank you, Senator French. I spoke to the Department of Public Safety after last we met. What this does is move this committee's proposed mechanism for ensuring compliance from Title 44 to Title 12. And the reason for that is because Title 1262-130 also applies to what kind of criminal justice information the department is required to collect, but it also mandates that the local agencies comply with what the Department of Public Safety has asked them for. And this rewrite puts the onus on the local agencies to comply when they're asked. It requires that the sex offense language be mandatory, and it gives the Department of Public Safety a tool to use, which is to say to the local agencies, if you don't comply, this may expose you to losing grant funding that you get through the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you for that explanation. With that, I'm going to remove my objection to number 2 and see if there's further objection. And hearing and seeing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. That brings us to amendment number 3, which is also going to be by myself, Senator French. I'll move it. I'll object to it. And this is what Ms. McClain has forever emblazoned it with the a moniker of the section formerly known as Section 3, which is now back in the bill. So we've reached an agreement. This pertains to the mental state required, mental state that the Department of Law has to prove in order to convict someone of failure to register as a sex offender. We took Section 3 out because I was concerned about it. I read the Moffitt case yesterday. I concur with your view that it would leave the state in a nearly impossible position when it comes to proving failure to appear under the Moffitt decision. And so I still think there has to be some mental element. We put it as low as you can go, I believe, criminal negligence. And so that's essentially what we've done, is say that in order to prove someone for failure to register as a sex offender, we'll also use the same standard in the failure to appear provision in the bail bill. I think that sort of leaves the Department of Law in the best position while still maintaining some sort of mental element with respect to what you have to prove with respect to what's in the mind of the offender. Let me turn to Ms. McClain.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is what we asked for. Having the legislature specify mental states for us is very helpful from being always exposed to the challenge to unspecified mental states. I would like to correct one thing I said when I was here last. I talked about the Moffitt decision and the standing for the proposition. I just want to make it very clear that the most recent decision is Solomon versus State, decided March 26, which clearly says that the mental state of negligence survives constitutional challenge.
Excellent. First rate. Senator Wilikowski.
So what's the current standard right now? Is it?
Well,
I thought it was a sort of a strict liability standard.
And quite frankly, this is a compromise. Excuse me, through the chair. The Department of Law feels comfortable that we could, with regard to failure to register as a sex offender, that we could defend a strict liability standard. And we have always thought that it was one. And I want to be very clear about this. We have always recognized that the mental state that we have to prove is that the person knew they had to register as a sex offender. In other words, that we had to show documentation in some manner, shape, or fashion that proved this person had notice of their duty to register, and having notice, didn't do so. We felt that was sufficient. We've never had a challenge to sex offender registration on those grounds. That is what we're proving. But given Moffitt, we're kind of trying to have some foresight about possible challenges and say, okay, Moffitt exists because there's no specified mental state in either of those statutes. So we want to.
And just for the record, Moffitt pertains to a failure to appear in court, although it's a similar idea, failure to appear versus failure to register. Right.
Senator Wilkowski. Can you just explain, I'm a little more tuned in now to the argument. Can you just briefly explain what the Moffitt court held?
Moffitt court held.
As to the standard.
I could run it. I just highlighted it. It's up on my desk.
It is an interesting intellectual pursuit because you'll recall that the general rule, excuse me, through the chair, is that if a statute doesn't specify a mental state, the mental state is knowing as to circumstances, reckless as to conduct. That's what our Alaska statutes say about statutes that don't specify a mental state. Up until the Moffitt decision, which was just last year, our understanding of failure to appear was the state had to prove that the person knew they had to appear, and we would do that by paperwork they signed or recordings of the judge telling them they had to appear, and that we believed we satisfied the reckless mental state by showing that they were aware of this.
The court date,
and disregarded it. And Moffitt took us by surprise because Moffitt said, no, you have to disprove the excuses they might have for not appearing, which is impossible.
Right. I mean, as I recall, they basically said you have to prove that at some date after that notice, after he walked out of court, the defendant formed in his mind the decision not to come to court.
Exactly right.
And that just struck me as being impossible.
It is absolutely impossible.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, what's wrong with a strict liability standard, though? What's wrong with saying you don't register as a sex offender, regardless of whether you went to vacation, regardless of whether you forgot, it's a strict liability standard. You're guilty. Is that, you're saying that violates Moffitt?
No, I think the Department of Law, frankly, likes that, and I was uncomfortable with it. It just struck me as being, there's it leaves some little room for, series of horrific incidents that leaves a person unable to register, either through something at criminal negligence or below, right? I think that's right.
If I could just say, how do you define that? What's the technical definition of criminal negligence?
The technical definition of criminal negligence is the person was unaware of a fact of which the person would have been aware, and that the failure to be aware of it was a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. And if the reason you're not aware is because you were intoxicated, you're aware.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, just maybe a couple examples. Person goes on vacation. and person moves, let's say, gets a new apartment in another community, it's a pretty tight registration requirement. Doesn't register, you know, busy moving, doesn't register, they forget. Under current law, they're strictly liable. They're guilty. Is that criminal negligence, though?
Excuse me, through the chair. No, that's strict liability. And as I said, that's not been challenged, and that's what we've been proving. we became concerned when we got this decision in the failure to appear context. It was the department's desire to codify what we think the law is, and we think it is strict liability. But as opposed to having it not codified at all, I guess at this point we're willing to compromise.
But in that case where the person just moves to another community and just forgets to re-register, would that be criminal negligence?
Yes. Excuse me, through the chair, I believe that, I think that's clearly criminal negligence. Unfortunately, under the Moffitt standard, the way that it exists with the crime of failure to appear, under the Moffitt standard, just forgetting is an excuse, and it's not only an excuse, and it's an excuse we have to disprove as part of our case in chief.
I'm not feeling real comfortable at this point, Mr. Chair, to be
fair,
frank with you.
Fair enough. I mean, this is a committee discussion. My view is I was reluctant to put someone in jail on strict liability. And even though failure to register as a sex offender is something that, you know, you should be punished for, I was a little uncomfortable with strict liability. If the committee feels differently, I'll accept the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cotter.
Just to chime in, what would be the practical outplay of the strict liability, though? I mean, most of what we've heard under the various different laws we have the highest standard, and then we have some discretion on application. So help me understand, if we put a strict liability in here and they fulfilled a majority of these but failed in maybe one point.
Strict liability, and Ms. McClain, feel free to chime in if I don't state the law correctly, basically leaves you with zero excuses whatsoever. You were told to register, you didn't register. We don't care if, we don't care if your mother was shot to death that day that you were supposed to go to court. We don't care if you were crashed into by a car and you were unable to get there. It's strict liability. Now the Department of Law always has the discretion not to bring a charge, but strict liability, strict liability. Yeah. Ms. McClain.
If I may, we did in the section formerly known and now again known as 3, provide that the excuse was an affirmative defense. That is, that the court has to listen to it and the jury gets to decide it, so that the defendant doesn't lose the defense. And strict liability would say you do lose the defense. Strict liability is, and typically you see this in cases of things like misbranded drugs, where ultra-hazardous materials, there is no excuse you can offer that the jury gets to consider. We aren't saying that. In our version of the bill, before we wrote in the negligent mental state before this amendment, we simply said you don't have to prove a mental state with regard to the actual failure to appear. The mental state you have to prove is that, with regard to the actual failure to register, you have to prove the person knew they had to register. We accept that burden. Beyond a reasonable doubt, we have to prove that. But if they've got an excuse, then that's their affirmative defense to say, these are my excuses, and then the burden shifts back to the state to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that those excuses are valid. That's how we would want to do this law. But as I said,
that's why we're
Senator French is explaining his point of view as well.
Right. Well, I see both sides of the argument. I see your, I certainly under, someone whose mother's shot, grieving, doesn't register for a day, I can understand that, but I can also understand the need and desire to want to have a strict liability standard. So I think I would probably need to read Moffitt a little bit more and understand this a little bit better, Mr. Chair. I just don't feel comfortable with this right now.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we, we're having a meeting this afternoon. Why don't we, oh, I won't be there. Well, maybe that's better for everybody.
You know, I can just say it was out of my control. why don't we just take a a 5 minute at ease and let people think it over. After having conferred with my colleagues, I am going to withdraw amendment number 3. And so amendment number 3 is withdrawn. In order to get, we need to do a conceptual amendment right now. And the conceptual amendment is to reinsert section 3 as it appeared in the original SB 222.
Mm. Oh. With backslash.
Okay. Brief at ease. Okay. The record, and my amendment, it's a conceptual amendment, is to is in two parts. First, to reinsert the original section 3 of SB 222 as it appears in backslash A. That's part one of the motion. The other part of the motion is to insert a new section which would be parallel to Section 21, as it appears in CS for House Bill number 298, Judiciary, backslash R Romeo, on page 11 of that bill. There's a Section 21 that says this: the uncodified law of the state of Alaska is amended by adding a new section to read, Legislative Statement Concerning Culpable Mental State, in AS 1156-840A, which is failure to register as a sex offender. The legislative in 1156-840A, as repealed and reenacted by Section 3 of this Act, the only culpable mental state required to be proven by the prosecution is the knowing requirement in paragraph 2 of that subsection. No other culpable mental state needs to be proven for the other elements of that offense. That's the amendment. We'll call that amendment number 4, as proposed by me. Is there a discussion of the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, the conceptual amendment is adopted, and the poor drafters will just have to catch up to us. With that, any other amendments to come before the committee? Hearing and seeing none, are we ready for a motion? We are ready for a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to CS for Senate Bill 222 backslash version E, I would move that we move the bill out of committee as amended, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved, and we are adjourned. Thank you.